2017. Thank you all for joining us. Introductions. I'm Jeff Riston with Kingston Homes, Moss Riston.
Art Gaither, Gaither Lynch.
Eric Lino, SGA Engineering.
Andrew Gunther, BLS Engineering.
Jamie Housley, Jordan Ramis.
Mike Ogren, Olson Engineering.
Don Hardy, Bo Jeremy.
Okay, we can go to the back of the room.
Laura Lebowski, Clark County Community
Planning.
Yeah. Diana
Development. Houston, Alabama. Mount Yonson, Alabama. Madison, Alabama.
Hey.
Chris Farrell, Clark County Program.
Okay.
Staff
Okay. Okay. Doing introductions, Rod?
Rod Swanson, Clark County Public Works.
And last? But not least. All right, thank you all for joining us. I'd like to remind everyone that this meeting is being recorded. The audio is posted on DEEB's website. Review and adopt the minutes. I'm going to have a chance to review them.
I have reviewed them and I move to approve as written.
Okay.
I'll second that.
Second. Any discussion, changes, comments? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right, minutes are adopted. Upcoming events, Ollie?
Next DEEB meeting, Thursday, November 2nd, 2:30 to 4:30, this room. The agenda will be titled for the Development Code Amendment and Cottage Housing. The next item will be Utility Engineering Plan Coordination and Approval. And then the other item will be Project Delivery Stakeholder Group Updates. The Board of County Councilors work session and hearing. There is a work session on October 11th at 9:30 a.m. Regarding annexation issues. The next meeting is developers agreement for Boys and Girls Club on Tuesday, October 17th. That is a hearing, by the way. The work session for 2018 docket amendment, Wednesday, October 18th at 11 a.m. BOCC hearing on CRESA Public Development Authority on Tuesday, October 24th at 10 a.m. BOCC work session, 2017 readout supplemental. Wednesday, October 25th at 11 a.m. Planning Commission work sessions and hearing. A work session for update CPC 2017-0017 public facility zone. Proposed changes to sidewalk program ranking criteria and biannual code changes. That would be on Thursday, October 5th at 5:30 p.m.
Today.
Planning Commission hearing, 2017 annual plan amendment, amending the 20-year growth management comprehensive plan and zone map, and biannual code amendment on Thursday, October 19th at 6:30 p.m. That's all we have on the
book. Okay. Sounds good. Thank you.
The docket items PC 2017-0017 public facilities.
Okay. I'm sorry, which one is that? Is that October 19th? Is the hearing?
Correct.
Okay. So the work session is today.
Yes.
And the hearing is also on the 19th hearing. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions, comments? All right. Moving on, we have DEEB member announcements. Any DEEB member announcements? I think we're going to bring Jan up at this point. Is that right, or, well, go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, I've got one, and I can't remember if I brought it up last meeting or not, but I had been involved with a group put together by Dean Shaddix, working with Clark Public Utilities on their joint trench program and issues associated with that, and have come up with some ideas with regards to CPU's early review of engineering plans so that they can get an early look at items with regards to any conflicts. These conflicts mainly revolve around stormwater facilities, primarily those bioretention facilities within the right-of-way. Ott was also on that group. Basically, what it came down to was where previously we would send final engineering plans to CPU at the time that we would be submitting to the county, that we're going to be getting them lateral designs early so that they can start taking an early look. This also is in concert and kind of with the buy-in with the two electrical designers out there, Cascade and Prairie, to where they would start their design earlier in the process than what has typically been the status quo, meaning we have complete plans and they start their design, and they oftentimes will lag behind with their electrical design. And so the coordination, there is no coordination. You don't find out any conflicts until you're out there on the site, and that's been an issue with inspections and making field adjustments that might involve anything from some redesign to tearing out stuff or relocating stuff. We've come up, as mentioned, with some ideas of the early review by CPU, the early design for the electrical work on site. This is primarily for subdivisions. And they are probably going to be implementing a pilot program to where they'll get a couple of firms to get on board and get some early designs out to the electrical designers early, and then pass along not only their designs, but pass along the AutoCAD designs for the civil engineering work, primarily the utilities. And then CPU will take a look at those plans in-house, overlay the electrical with the civil design, see if there's any conflicts. This, of course, will also be peripherally, the other purveyors, other dry utility purveyors, will be peripherally working on this too, with gas and cable and fiber optic. And then the idea being that there might be a checklist item or on the cover sheet for the civil engineering plans that CPU has reviewed the plans. What we were trying to avoid was a separate process. Anything that would make the final engineering plan review process take longer, which is why we want to get them in earlier. And really what it ends up being is just a kind of a checklist item, and that on the engineering plans that there would be a checklist or checkbox that says, yes, CPU has reviewed this for any conflicts, and that's it. So first thing will be a pilot program, see how it works in real life, make any tweaks, and take it from there. We had, two meetings with them? And
Two or three.
And I think it's going to work out. I mean, what we're trying to avoid here, and what Public Works Inspection is trying to avoid, were those conflicts in the field. As long as they can get an earlier look at it, and CPU's earlier look at it. And CPU will be doing the lion's share of the work, and they're happy to do it. Peripherally to that, also getting plans, site plans to CPU early is something else that they'd like to see happen, and what they'll probably be doing is commenting at the pre-app stage with regards to providing, notifying applicants and applicants' consultants to get them plans early so that they can take a look at any other conflicts, primarily overhead aerial line conflicts, pole relocations. Oftentimes it's not until you have final engineering plans, you get out on site, and you realize that you've got several poles that need to be relocated that weren't contemplated in either a pro forma or cost estimates, and now all of a sudden you have to move them and the developer's on the hook to pay for them. So they'd also like to take an earlier look at that. so that they can advise the applicants or developers of what might need to take place. So it's really an early, it's almost akin to a utility review, and they're happy to do this. They do get notifications of, or they're going to now start getting notifications of pre-application conferences, so that they're able to take a look at the plans and provide any comments.
What about the conflict with transformers?
That was not part of the conversation.
That was not, okay.
No, that's kind of, that's a little more detailed, a little more drilled down. They were taking a look at the more the bigger picture. That is not yet been fully resolved, although we've met with them and one of our clients to figure out a way that CPU can notify property owners or future purchasers of projects of the limitations and the setback issues that they have, and it would be something on that runs with title, that is a letter or notification of what the setback requirements are. This is kind of, and I'm not sure, I'm not sure if this is in lieu of something placed on the plat, like a plat note, but they're feeling that a plat note might not be enough because not everybody looks at the plat, but that it runs with title of the property and they are fully aware of the setback limitations. I don't think we're gonna get any traction. CPU's pretty much dug their heels in with regards to cement fiber siding.
Really?
Yeah.
Even though the IBC and everything else defines it differently.
Yeah, and what they explained to us is that it's not the fact that it goes up in flames, but it heats up and it's everything behind it that can go up in flames. It's kind of like a frying pan.
Have they ever said how many times that has happened?
And that's anyway. Just it. And when we've asked that question, their response has been, well, none, or it's been very rare, but we want to make sure that it doesn't happen in the future. And they've of course given the extremes of the conditions that they've run into with transformers being built right next to porches or even porches having to be built around them. They've talked about easements with regards to being able to provide not only a transformer but telephone cable risers in the same area. So that I don't think that the plane has been totally landed on that yet, but there are some potential solutions that CPU is amenable to. I just don't know what the outcomes are.
Okay. Who's working on that? Is anyone? I thought this group we had.
Yeah, Dean Shaddix actually is Dean, kind of coordinating. He will be in here. In
that's right.
And for an expanded version of this discussion.
Yeah.
And he moved to. We had a light agenda, then we got a heavy agenda, and then he moved to next month. So.
Yeah, right. And I think that's pretty good. And I think he's going to give a more detailed presentation on that very thing. Next
Perfect.
Month.
Perfect. Thanks, Mike.
Sure.
Any other DEEB member announcements?
Just one other one. Attended a board work session last month on the potential for a transfer of development rights program. And I think that the board was going to get some more information on that and maybe coming down the pike and just something for Deeb to be aware of.
Okay. Marty?
So many of you know the council approved us entering into a consultant search for evaluating our permit center processing and operations. We had five proposals submitted by five different firms. They were received on the 13th of September. We had a group of folks, including Jamie and Mike and Councillor Olson here, review the proposals. We met Tuesday, kind of scored them, ranked them. I'm doing a reference check on the number one scoring and ranked firm. So I hope to get a bit more information on the scope of work, maybe slightly refined. Attach that to a contract and get it in front of the council probably in the next two to three weeks. So we will have a consultant on board probably by the end of the month, and that that consultant has a task list that is about a 5-month-ish window. The one thing I liked is that they have a lot of experience on the West Coast. I've been doing some reference checking with very recent engagements with cities and counties, meaning this year. They're sensitive to the the timing in November, December with holidays and whatnot. So you'll see, you know, something coming out, and it will be in front of the council in the next couple of weeks.
Okay.
Thank you to the folks who took the time to review the proposals, and we'll get a good product out of it.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Any others? We brought Jan. I think Jan's just going to quickly give us an update on biennial code.
Right. Biennials are going to the Planning Commission tonight in the work session. I sent out the staff report Monday, and basically in it, I'm stating in the report that the DEEV has recommended approval of all items except the RV standards and the corner lot site distance item. Just for your information, the item numbers in the process have been changed. One of the prior versions had a bunch of small items grouped together under one. So in order to proceed through the process and see if everything, I had to break those out. So the numbers increased, so now there's 49 total items. Anyway, it adjusted the numbers, but the text of the code changes haven't changed. And so the corner site distance language that went out in the staff report, or the staff report, is the same version as has recently been circulated. So I believe, or my assumption at the time when the motion was made not to support it, I think maybe it was because it wanted to be extended to other zones, but I don't know if that's the case. So I handed out the latest version that Greg circulated around, and that's, I provided a copy of that. And so again, this is the version that went to DC in their packets. So that's where we are.
I can give an update on the status of the corner lot driveway. So we did have, the reason why it was not supported last time is because of the ordering of the way they wrote it. It changed it significantly from what we previously supported. And it basically was more restrictive than what we started with. So we went back kind of the drawing board, we met with the county, kind of went over some concerns. So several of the builders were there, a few other people in the back. Houston was here, I'm not sure if anyone else in the room is there. But we went over the code section, and we came to an agreement. I think we're at 95% there. The language you have in front of us is kind of in front of you now is what we agreed upon. The one sticking point was in section 4B1B that talks about the zones. So this was now added that basically says that if you can't be in the site distance, if you're inside the site distance triangle, which is very difficult to get a driveway on narrower lots. So when you look at the way those site triangles lay out, your corner lots have to be about 60 feet to even get a 20-foot driveway. So what we looked at was we added a new section where in those zones, in the case of medium and high density residential zones, R12, R18, R22, R30, R43, where this may be practical, the driveway may be limited to 20 feet in width and located 5 feet from the property line and away from the intersection as a 25-foot shared driveway at the property line. And that the engineer can use traffic control devices, including stop signs, to preserve or manage site distance. So this is a significant change and a good step in the right direction, where we looked before at, you know, we were eliminating up to sometimes 4 to 8 lots at an intersection, just so we didn't put a stop sign in. When you're looking at trying to balance competing interests in those narrower zones, we can't regulate them like we did larger lots. And this is kind of a leftover where these uncontrolled intersections work fine in larger neighborhoods where you have less density and you can put a house, you know, 30 feet from the corner. When you're in narrow lots, you're competing with density goals in the comp plan, you're competing with affordable housing, and you really can't lose that many lots of intersections to meet those other goals. So I think it was a good step in the right direction, and we had a great conversation. I think the one dissent was Some of the other smaller single-family zones, maybe the medium-density zones, R1, what was it?
R5, R6.
And I think you have mixed use because you're at a 12 acre.
Mixed use is one we probably should add in regardless because those are very similar to townhouses. So we might want to look at adding the mixed use zones in there. I don't think there'd be any like conflict between staff and the development community on mixed use.
Can you have like lots, individual lots in mixed use? Or
you can.
Yeah.
Townhouse style.
I haven't seen one, that's why I haven't seen one mixed use that has individual lots. But again,
So with the counties, so we would like to see them expanded to the R15, R16, because typically in those zones, you're not quite at 60-foot wide lots. The typical lots are still smaller. They can be 40 foot on average.
Yeah, I think minimum lot width in R15 is 45 feet.
45.
And R16, and I think minimum lot depth in R15 is actually 65 feet. So, I mean, a lot of the talk you were talking about was all width of the lots, okay, when that's fine, but when you start to shrink the lots under 100 feet down to a 90, your site distance corner is going to get a little tougher for the property to be allowed to go a lot more stuff as well. So that's really where it's going to get the R15. If you have a couple of chunks of lots in there, that's your standard 50 by 100, then you get an R15, and then on your corners as well. Ideally, you like to go to your corners to 55 feet to add 5 feet for that street setback, but it's not always possible. So you will have situations where you'll have a 45 foot bottom interior on the corner, and that's just the way it has to be. That would be a whole lot of building on your lot, especially because it's a little shallower. But that way that site distance works, you're going to have to push your house back. So you're going to push your houses back too because of the site distance. So when you typically have an interior lot, the same dimension, the driveway would be 18 feet. When you put that same house on the corner, your driveway is now like 29 feet or 28 or 6 feet. So you're running into quite a bit of competing interest there as well. And then I think the other two issues are the mixed use, because the mixed use for residential, I think, has a minimum of 12 per acre and a maximum of 43. So you're essentially hitting all those zones you just said were okay, but you're not putting in there. And then a PUD standard. So with PUDs, you can mix your product in there so you can still put townhomes in your lots, especially if you're mixing two densities, a high density and a medium density or low, you can automatically pop into that R12. Density bonus promotion as well. So if you're in R15 and you get a density bonus promotion, you get the effectively at R12. So how is the county going to handle that? So I'd like to see if they can address those mixed use portions, the PUDs, and potentially R15. R16 isn't going to get as bad because your minimum lot depth is 90 feet and it's 50 feet, which
it's close.
It's close. You're going to run into 55 feet you can make work in most situations, ideally would be 60. So without putting those two zones in there, you're effectively setting your corner setbacks at about 15 feet without actually changing the setbacks. It's the kind of the way I'm looking at it and shaping far.
Sure. Well, thank you for that information. Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Houston, I just want to be sure I'm clear on what you're asking. So you've seen this is what you're referring to.
Yeah,
he was on the committee. You're on the committee. What you're requesting is that the zones be expanded to include R1.
Yeah, mixed use, R15 at a minimum, and then I think the PUD needs to be addressed as well. R16 can go either way. If staff feels strongly that R16 should be allowed, I can live with it, but I think R15, just because of the size of the lot, so if it allows, which is a minimum 45 on the width and 65, I believe, on the depth, it should be included as well, because you're just looking at average lot sizes, and that should you could have an outlier.
So there were emails that went around. Eric, I don't know if you want to speak. It seemed like to me that the committee itself agreed that the mixed use I'm not sure if I saw that. But the R15 and R16 seemed like the committee, or a good chunk of the committee anyway, was advocating for that. Staff wasn't quite sure what they wanted to do.
Yep.
I think what Jan's looking for, and what we were talking about, do we write a formal, you know, we were talking about originally a formal letter of approval. We're kind of down to where we're at now because we have a couple of these outstanding issues, and what Jan's looking for is direction as to what he tells the Planning Commission, how Dee feels about the biannuals in general, and then...
That's a good segue for the motion I was going to propose here next.
Perfect.
So
hoping you would.
Okay. So the motion, let me try to get it worded properly, is that Dee supports this revised language submitted, but asks that they consider adding additional zones, including the mixed-use zones, R15 and R16, into section 4B1B.
Mm-hmm. Houston mentioned PUDs.
Yeah.
Oh, and PUDs. Yes. Okay, from the yes.
But PUDs is not a zone.
It's not a zone, but I don't know how
it results in it.
So address it. That's why I brought it up, but
let me amend, and then special consideration being given to PUDs and density transfers. Because that's where, when you look at the R15, I think that fits it. R16, I don't think it does. I think you can work around it, but if you do it as part of a PUD, or you have density transfer, you basically are taking on R16 lots and you're bringing them down to something closer to an R112. So, to kind of repeat the motion then, that we include the mixed-use zones, R15 and R16, and special consideration being given to PUDs and density transfer.
Second.
So,
okay, so we have a second discussion.
Either he second, Jamie second.
Was there a second? There was, right?
Yeah, Jamie.
Yeah, okay. Discussion.
So what would be the arguments against expanding the shared driveway, I guess, required distance, this code section, right. The applicable.
Not to speak for the public works director, but when we run this by Heath Henderson, he thought that, you know, when you log in to do certain zoning and density, we can, you know, kind of sacrifice safety. That's what he sees it as. But when you have choices to provide wider lots at the intersection, why should the safety, you know, be put on the back burner and try to put a stop sign everywhere? So he thought that we should kind of, meet in the middle. The development community gets some of these, you know, like what we did in the language, and then development community also design their project to provide wider lot at the intersection when they can. So that's the reason, and there is a, you know, some type of opinion against putting stop sign everywhere, because with the if we even revise the code and allow it even more, now instead of like, you know, maybe 50% of the intersection in a, you know, residential area, it's gonna turn into 80% stop sign. Sort of, you know, that's the logic behind it. But again, we can take it back and see, you know, what he thinks. You know, at the end of the day, he's the one who will be, you know, responsible for, you know, people call and complain about why there is a stop sign here, nobody stops, and you know the drill. So we are trying to, you know, avoid some situation that, you know, and have to backtrack. That was the reason for it. But again, we can probably discuss.
I follow up to your question. So before Eric's amendment, are you supportive of this document?
Yes, the language.
You're supportive of it. So,
yeah.
So in certain zones, you're okay with it.
Sure.
You're concerned about the full expansion of it.
Exactly.
Not necessarily the use in certain zones.
Yeah, with the proposed language or the proposed recommendation, the only zoning that we won't get, you know, this situation and stops and is R175 and R10.
And R20.
And R20.
Ali, I'm not trying to be argumentative, I'm just trying to follow the logic. So why would you be okay with some of it, but not okay with all of it, other than, well, we'll get more phone calls because there'll be more interaction, and even though it's good in some cases,
sure,
we're just not comfortable with it being good everywhere.
Right.
I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, actually, it's very simple. With this zone, you don't have a lot of choices. You have to meet your density, and you have to make your project density down. And you probably buy the land and not more expensive, I'm just guessing.
Yeah.
So the logic is that since you're locked in, you know, by the zoning planning code, so we need to work with you. Now, why should the county allow, you know, stop sign everywhere when you really are not forced into doing it? I'm sure that more lots is the better. I mean, we don't dispute that, but at the same time, there are places that you provide right of way, you improve roads, you know, to provide more safety. You do all type of, you know, work in order to, you know, look at the safety and address them. This could be one of them too.
So that's
the logic.
I understand what you're saying.
With
thank
this
you.
Language you're forced into, that's why the county realized that.
Thank you.
That we don't have choices, a lot of choices here.
So just really quickly, I was on the committee when I was able to make it. The whole stop sign issue was kind of an interesting one, and I just want Deeb to be aware of it. I mean, I think, you know, stop signs, you know, you've got warrants, and that's the warrants are when a stop sign is needed, when you need a stop sign. In our opinion, the warrants don't say you can't have a stop sign. So then we got into this whole discussion about drivers' expectations and things like that, you know, and we talked about like some of the changes that were made up on Salmon Creek and things where you've got existing neighborhoods, stop signs have been put in, and drivers' habits, their habits and expectations, drivers' habits are already existed because it's a neighborhood that's existed, and they run the stop sign. Our argument was you put a stop sign in, the driver's expectations and habits in a new neighborhood are now there's a stop sign there. From the county standpoint, the county's worried about liability. From the subcommittee standpoint is you put in a stop sign there, someone runs it and there's an accident, your liability is gone. And then there was a question of enforcement, and we said you put a stop sign there, you run it, and there's a cop behind you, more likely you get pulled over. There'll be cases where people are pulled over so you can prove that you are enforcing it. So I do want to say that it comes down to, do we want stop signs or not want stop signs? And it really, I think, unless I'm oversimplifying it, that's what it comes down to. I don't know how many people call and say, oh, my new neighborhood has stop signs and I don't like them. It's more the old neighborhoods maybe, but yeah, you know.
I think we resolved that issue. At the time, the opinion was that we were talking about stop sign as a traffic control.
Cool.
Slow down.
Right.
That is a still requires warrants. You have to have certain criteria to be
right.
This one is not to address traffic control. So
no,
it's a different, yeah.
Right, but it's addressing, but there's nothing that stops us from putting stop signs there, is what I'm saying. It's more
right.
of a, it's
for this purpose, that's true.
So
yeah, for this purpose, that's true.
Anyway, so I just wanted to make, that was kind of the back and forth that went along with that. So we have a motion. Any other discussion?
I heard Houston talk about or mention density transfers being particularly important. So you can go from a certain zoning and actually because of the density transfer, you're effectively into an R12 zone or something.
Correct. Like in an R15 and the PUD, I believe you'd be up to a 10% density bonus in that circumstance. And if you maximize the density there, you are effectively in an R12 zone.
I'm just throwing something out here just to see if there's some kind of a middle ground, because I heard you, Houston, say, okay, I could live without this in the R16 zone. You could live without it.
Because typically in an R16 zone, your lots are a little bit wider. Okay?
Yeah.
I mean, typically in R16 zone, you're 60 by 100. R15 or 50 by 100, which you can go down to 45, and in some circumstances you have to go to 45. What the county's arguing here or trying to put out is, you know, well, you do have the flexibility to make your corner lots wide. Yeah, I do have the flexibility, but it also hurts my bottom line, and it's not always feasible with the lot lines, okay? If they really want corners to be wider, I suggest that they look at the setbacks as a means of doing that, because then it's not going to hurt all the lots that are in under construction with this, because right now this, now I got a 45-foot lot, and I can't park a car in the driveway, okay? A little hard for me to deal with that when I have a finished lot, but if I know ahead of time, okay, I got a new plat, I'm designing it, okay, they want these corner lots 60 feet, and that's the standard, so you can fit your driveway in there with the cars, then I can handle that. I'm not really advocating for a 15-foot street setback, but that's kind of what they're trying to enforce without changing the code. That makes sense.
Okay. So we have a motion. Any other discussion? Yep. Any other discussion? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. So the motion carries with the recommended amendments to include R15, R16, QD, and mixed use. Is that correct? And what about RV? Do we need to touch on RV, or we got that?
I would like to make a motion on that.
Thank you.
Jan, does the current, before I make my motion, does the current version that went to PC, we don't have the copies in our packet, but the current version that went to PC address that one other last comment that I had that I copied everybody on with regards to vehicles parked in such spaces shall not encroach?
Yes.
Okay. I just like a little bit of background. I think Jan did a great job on this. He reached out to utility purveyors, water purveyors, and such with regards to water connections, got some clarifications on lengths of stay, really did his homework after my initial comments. So with that, I would recommend recommending approval of the new RV standards as currently written.
A second.
Just a question.
Yeah.
On the 90. I know the 90 days was a question mark, and Jan responded to that. My only thought on this is we have an aging community. There's a lot of people that are going to Phoenix, coming back from Phoenix. And is 90 the appropriate number? If we're going to pick a number on the number.
Is it too long or too short?
I think it might be too short. I mean, I'm just recognizing their, you know, the aging population, from a market position, you know, I get the resident piece. It's not supposed to be a permanent resident, but what should that number be? That's just my thought.
Is there a standard now?
I don't know if there is. I mean, I think that, you know,
we're establishing a standard. I think your research showed that there was a range.
Right.
30 days, 60 days, you landed on the higher range of what you saw in other codes?
Yeah, I saw one that was 180 days. Many did not have any standard. I mean, our typical policy or standard is that you don't camp or live in an RV for more than 30 consecutive days or 60 days of a calendar year. That's the county's policy. It's in the home code. That's what code enforcement uses when people are living in their RVs. It's 30 days. So this is a significant increase from that. And, you know, the purpose is to not have these permanent residences.
I'm kind of looking at it from, and I get that, Jan, but from more the affluent piece of this, which I think is another part of that, is you have a lot of people that have sold their houses, and I've, you know, family members, et cetera, that have done that, and they're traveling in an RV. They may have another place in Phoenix where they're living, So it's not necessarily about being a bad thing, people staying longer. It's a perspective. You know, that's just my...
I may be missing the boat on the intent of this, but
yeah.
I wouldn't be as concerned about the affiliate. I'm wondering, is there a case to be made for, this is someone's affordable housing, and if the environment is proper, the amenities are there, the utilities are there, do we want to prevent a form of affordable housing? And the answer could be yes. I mean, it's just, the answer could be yes, this is not appropriate in this location for this use, but it could be. That's something that I'm struggling with a little bit.
And all of this could have been discussed over the last month while we were, you know, sending stuff through, and here we are in the kind of the 11th hour, 59th minute, and now we're bringing these up. So I just wanted to put that out there too.
Yeah. All right. So we have a motion. I don't think we had a second.
Second.
We have a second from Eric. A rousing second.
Yes.
All right. Any discussion?
I just want to make one more thing. To your point, Mike, I think part of our responsibility is to make a case for it. And the case sometimes need to be articulated. Not everybody's going to read emails. It's going to go to the PC or maybe the council. But I think it's helpful to make a case for it in certain conditions. So I'm okay with spending a few minutes reviewing, hey, here's the background, here's the reason why, here's the reason for and against.
Okay. And we can push through this agenda. So, I mean, this biannual thing, it's an important thing, and this has been a tough year with these biannual changes. So, and this is kind of our last shot at it. So is there anyone having discussion with Don?
What's the motion?
I think the motion is to
adopt as currently written,
which we don't have in front of us. You said, right?
It was circulated by email.
Yeah,
it was circulated by email.
Yeah,
and keep in mind that we have the option too to amend a motion.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to vote.
And I guess to that point, Mike, I'm sorry for the last minute delay.
No worries.
To that, I mean, I would suggest we go 6 months, 180 days, if we're going to put a time limit on it. I mean, that's, you know, 90 just seems like, I mean, if I'm an RV purveyor, I mean, I'm not sure if I really understand the purpose of 90 days. I mean, I really am not getting it.
This is the 3 months of nice weather we have in the Northwest.
You know. It's like, okay, on the 91st day, you're booting them out. I mean, it's just, I'm not getting it.
So
I would propose an amendment to that, too, for the 90 days to be 180 days.
Okay. Does it go back to you, or does it go back to the second?
It goes back.
So it needs a second. For
I second it.
You second it?
Yes.
The 180?
Or but there's a proposed amendment.
There's a motion on the floor.
There's a motion on the floor discussion. So now we've got a friendly amendment, so it's back to you.
Well,
right?
There needs to be a second. It needs to be seconded.
I'll second.
Okay. All right.
So now we vote on the amendment.
Yeah.
Okay. All in favor of the amendment?
Which is what?
The amendment is, so staff is proposing 90, and Don is proposing
180. Okay, so we're voting on the 180.
Yes.
Right, which staff has said they've seen.
Is staff really not supportive of the we haven't heard from staff on 120, really. Did they really not like the 120 days?
180. 6 months.
Okay, how does staff feel about that? Well, we've been discussing the 90, and it's gone through on the emails, but I don't know if staff has a real objection to it. If they care.
Did staff can comment to PC at the hearing tonight, or at the workshop?
Work session.
Yeah. You know, I guess there's a concern that these are not residences, and the longer they're there, the more likely that they'll
start setting up
the expectation. I can't say that I know that 90 is the right number. I'm not going to say that. This is This is something that we put out there. The various codes do, like Palm Springs, where people go and live half the year, 180 days.
Okay.
Other places, less so. You know, are we expecting to get people that come back and forth for half the year? I haven't done my homework on that, to be honest.
No.
This personal observation, and it may just be the people I hang out with, there are people that spend 6 months here. I don't know if they would stay 6 months. I'm just kind of looking at it as a nice place to live. Not so much as like a highway stop, but you know, the intent is you're trying to really make it as good as it can be. You want people to stay longer. If it's the right venue for them, they would, you know, with amenities, it could be a good thing.
They'll spend in your community 3 months longer.
Yeah, and you know, it
also impact your services 3 months longer.
The decision makers to make that the final call, whatever you recommend as well.
Okay. So, what's that?
You can call for the vote.
Okay. Am I calling for the vote? I'm lost now again. I'm calling for the vote on the amendment. The amendment? All right. All in favor of the 180 amendment?
180-day.
180-day amendment from 90-day staff recommendation.
Aye.
How many ayes?
You better raise your hands.
Roll call. Yeah. Roll call. Okay, I'll give it. Well, I'm going to actually take my hand down. So.
Four. Five. Sorry. No, four.
One, two, three, four, five.
Five. Okay. 5-3, so it passes.
Okay, I just want to go on the record as stating my support of this is not for the affluent. It's for the people in this community that are struggling to find a place.
Yeah.
This may be a good alternative under the right conditions.
Yeah.
And I just don't want to, on carte blanche, just say you can't do it. It's illegal.
The parks can have their own restrictions.
They can have their own restrictions. There could be other conditions the county imposes. I just don't want it to be 90 days.
Okay. And that's good. And Jan, if you would pass the discussion along to the Planning Commission, along with the 5-3 vote. And I'm sorry for going like that, but that shows you how it's a very difficult when you're trying to pick these numbers. So, great. Is that all we have on biannuals then?
And you have to vote on
the original motion.
Thank you. Okay.
Approval.
Can we go back and vote on the original motion approval that Mike made? Does everyone remember that? And Eric seconded. All right. Which is
approval of this as written.
Yeah.
Plus as written.
Plus 180.
As written. Plus
prior version.
Yeah.
This is RV.
Not. Not the intersection
RV
one.
Yeah.
The RV one, which we don't have in front of us, right? Or we do?
We don't have it.
Okay, that's why I just want to make clear to everyone. Sorry.
I brought my comment.
It was circulated by email, so that we're going to voting on the rest of it plus the 180-day amendment.
Yes.
Seconded by Eric.
Sorry. So an affirmative vote would be in favor of the RV standard.
Yes.
With a 180-day limitation.
Correct.
Yes.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Perfect.
Yay.
It's just unanimous on that, and then 5-3 on the 180. The
additional
180. Okay. On the amendment. So the amendment for 180 passed as well as our recommendation. So that's biannual codes. Is there anything else you need on biannual codes? Other than that, I think you've gotten the support from Deeb that you wanted. There was discussion of a formal letter. You felt you didn't need a formal letter, that Deeb's recommendation was just fine.
Yes. So I will also provide additional information about your desires to amend the corner light extend the R15, R16.
Perfect.
Mixed use.
Perfect. So you have everything to move those forward?
Yes.
That you need from us?
And you know, if the hearing is on the 19th. If you want to have somebody attend and make your case, that would be certainly appropriate.
Okay. Great. Thank you, John.
Okay.
And then that was an addition to the agenda, but obviously we've been working on biannuals for a long time. Jan and staff, you've done a great job always a tough thing. So we had to get that done. So thank you. We'll see if we can push this agenda forward.
Thank you very much.
All right. Sidewalk program ranking criteria. Man, I chaired Planning Commission for a lot of years, but this is tougher. A tougher group. First off.
Because he got right here.
I've only got 2 months left. Good luck, Steve.
Good luck, Steve.
So first of all, I want to thank you guys for allowing us to come and talk with you about our sidewalk program. If you remember, we came to you a few months ago, maybe a little bit longer, to talk about the transportation improvement program. And as part of the transportation improvement program is our sidewalk program. And we're responsible for funding our assets, and we just want to make sure we're funding the right stuff. So that's why we're here today. Susan Wilson here with Michael Derlich and Chris Trump.
Thank you.
So what we like to do is stimulate some conversation. Your feedback is important to us, and we're going to go. We're just going to do the overview of the sidewalk program, and then also going to talk about the details of the ranking system. So as I said earlier, it's important to us that we are building the right sidewalk projects. We're also meeting with the Planning Commission, RTAC, and NAC to discuss just some of the details of the ranking system. We want to make sure we're not forgetting anything. Maybe things we haven't thought about that you guys may think about to make this program a little bit better, especially with how we evaluate our projects to fund. So we like to make sure that we are measuring the appropriate activities. We're looking at the best measurements. And then just things that I want just to think about is sidewalks in rural centers. And then also sidewalks on both sides of the street. Because right now, our funding partners really look at constructing sidewalks on one side of the street. But if you have projects such as like Highway 99, it might be appropriate to include them to add sidewalks on both sides. Those are the types of things, just questions to think about, things to stimulate some conversation. So currently, with our sidewalk program, we construct and replace sidewalks. We mostly do new construction of sidewalks. We do some replacements, as you might know. We just are under construction with Highway 99 from 63rd to 78th Street. We're adding a pedestrian signal there. That sidewalk was in real bad shape. We felt like that needed some replacement. Our sidewalk program consists of about $450,000 per year in county road fund.
And Susan, where does that money sourced from? Is that just general road fund or?
County road fund.
County road fund.
County road fund is property taxes, fuel taxes, and timber tax. So we get about $450,000 in our adopted transportation improvement program that's allocated to sidewalks per year. And that's just road fund. Other funding sources consist of state funds and state and federal grant funds. And that ranges from $200,000 to $700,000 per year. Some grant calls are every other year. So it just really depends upon what projects we come up with, the competition levels, and what and how much sidewalks cost and how much leveraging we have each year. And then also we construct about a quarter to a half a mile annually with our grants. So what we did in the past and what we want to do now, we just want to do something a little different. First of all, we want to take our evaluation system and we want to make it more consistent with our funding partners. Also, we are doing an inventory of all of our sidewalks. In the past, what we did was we got sidewalks from citizens who called in. So by doing an inventory of all of our sidewalks within the urban growth boundary, will give us more opportunity to put those sidewalks through an evaluation system and rank them with the criteria that we're going to present today, and to help fund these projects and to fund the right projects. So hoping to stimulate conversation to make sure that we're evaluating the right stuff.
The 250 to 300 per lineal feet, what does that include? It's got to be like some right-of-way acquisition.
That's right on price from design to construction.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
ADA ramps, okay. Curb.
So that's not really construction cost. That's actually
design. Okay, that's a huge construction cost. Well,
because that's way higher.
Way higher, yeah. Construction. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So there'll be one question that includes acquisition.
Yes.
Okay.
The total project cost, that is correct. I think you're up. Okay, Chris.
Continuing where Susan left off, some of our ranking goals included safety, connectivity, where people are going, all of which will be developed further in the next slides, but also to align, as Susan said, with our funding partners to get as much grant money to leverage quote money. Numeric ranking systems allow us to evaluate the projects and select the most beneficial ones to do. And again, aligning that with our grants could either allow the whole project to be 100% funded, for example, bike pedestrian grant or safe route to school grant, or partially funded. So in the last 5 years, we've written 16 grants for 10 different projects, 63% success rate, 10 of the 16 were funded, approximately $4.4 million out of 5.1, with 85.5% of the project being funded. We break it down into some major ranking categories: safety and comfort, destinations, implementation and constructability, and health outcomes, for example. For those that have the supplement, this is actually the third point, implementation. I'm going to jump around. But some of the implementation challenges that we try to avoid if possible, right-of-way acquisition, environmental issues like wetlands, structural support walls, and if there's a drop-off. We also consider pending development, so we don't construct a sidewalk that's going to eventually be ripped out for development.
Also, what we do is we like to have partnerships with agreements for, you know, a proportionate share with development. So that helps us score more points on the grants, and also helps us leverage our dollars.
Jumping back to the front, the top, safety and comfort, things to consider when we're ranking these is any events, collisions with bike or pedestrian. They get points, which is broken down on the criteria. Speed of roadway, 35 plus, for example, getting 10 of the most points within that subcategory. And also average daily traffic, even out of 10 value as well. Where people are walking, if worst case scenario, if they're walking within the existing 12 feet, for example, of roadway, that would be given the most points. If there's an available shoulder, whether it's marked or unmarked, it'll be given points accordingly with the shoulder itself. And other issues in terms of any safety issues, visibility, or any marked school zone will get points within the safety category. So I'm done with my time.
Thank you, Chris. So continuing on with some of the things we look at when we try and prioritize sidewalk investment, destinations is a very big thing. Connecting people to where they want to or need to walk to is both consistent with the county comprehensive plan and the 2010 bicycle and pedestrian plan, which was the basis of our earlier ranking system. Sidewalk grant programs, including TIB, transportation alternatives, and even federal ADA law, also encourage connecting the public to some of these specific destinations that you see here. One of the changes that we're proposing in this revised criteria to better align with TIV and further differentiate good projects from great projects is awarding 1 point if a particular type of destination is close to a proposed sidewalk project within 2 or 3 blocks, and more points if it is on the project, within the project from that. It's our hope that, again, that will help differentiate good projects from great projects. Another thing we look at is health and quality of life. This was very important to the Bicycle and Pedestrian Committee the last time we looked at the criteria, because sidewalks can have a very positive benefit on health and quality of life. Again, the county comp plan, various sub-area plans note this linkage and encourage linking neighborhoods and pedestrians to transit and other places they might like to travel to. Walkability is considered and is a general measure of how friendly an area is to walking. Several different definitions of that term, but that's the general thrust of that one. We would like to score projects a little higher if they're near affordable housing, as that's a criteria that's becoming more important to our granting agencies. And as far as affordable housing and economic factors, we are leveraging data that Clark County Public Health has assembled on various poverty rates and other census-based data throughout the county. When we go to apply all of these different ranking criteria, we propose totaling the points that you see on the sheet in front of you, similar to the way we're doing now with the various changes in criteria. We then like to take the highest scoring for the best fit projects for a particular grant and leverage our engineers in the department to do a more detailed project scoping to uncover some of the estimates that can make certain projects extremely costly, so that when we develop a cost estimate, it's much more accurate and we have fewer surprises when we get to construction. Oftentimes we're dealing with a sidewalk on the shoulder of the road, which is where we hide all the utilities and difficult stuff when we build the road. And now we're having to go over the top of that, and conflicts and expensive conflicts are not unusual. So we're hoping that with better scoping and a detailed estimate and review, we can come up with a better cost estimate and also attempt to calculate a cost-benefit score, where we, generally speaking, take the cost of the project and its raw ranking, multiply the two together to come up with a ratio. The higher the number, the higher the cost-benefit for a particular project. Then our proposal is to move those selected projects that have passed the second tier scoring forward, either adding them to the 6-year transportation program, writing a grant for them, or adding them to our annual sidewalk ongoing program and moving them forward to detailed scoping and formal design. Returning to the questions that Susan tasked you with when we started, we're curious, now that we've kind of stepped through the philosophy and some of the high-level details of our ranking, are we measuring the appropriate activities and are we using the best measurements for those? Thoughts, comments?
I really like what you put together here. The one question I have is, could ridership for C-TRAN be another component for scoring? Much like the Vine in Vancouver, which goes from downtown as Turtle Place to the mall, could that be another component about ridership?
Possibly. We can look at that. We do give points for being on or close to transit already. Ridership data we would have to get from C-TRAN, and that's doable. There have been a couple of grants I'm familiar with that have specifically where transit ridership numbers have helped us make a case, And in those particular instances, C-TRAN has been very helpful, but we found the ridership numbers can fluctuate greatly depending on where on the route you measure. But that is something we can look at, perhaps including ridership numbers as well as are you close to a route. Thank you. Other thoughts?
Just to make sure I understood, and destination signed transit stop, is that bus stops? Is that what that's referring
yes.
to? Okay, all right.
Yes.
I wasn't tracking on
yeah.
that.
Are thought. You? Are is there a bus stop between the project termini so you're right there on, or is the sidewalk helping you get to a bus stop that's two or three blocks away? Is the intent of that item?
On walkability, could you maybe explain to me what I'm not quite tracking. Is that tracking on density of the area of housing in that area, or what's walkability in reference to?
Density is measured separately. That's measured up at the top of destinations, and what we have been doing.
Got it.
Yeah. Walkability is a little bit more nebulous term. If you Google it, it has several definitions. For walkability, generally, how comfortable does the route feel? And for that, we are relying on our friends at Clark County Public Health that have created a nice county-wide map where they've used very detailed and multifaceted criteria to come up with a general walkability score. So rather than reinventing the wheel, we went with their data for this system.
Michael.
Yes.
Michael.
Yes.
Are you, this doesn't relate directly to your question, but as you examine the overall need for sidewalks in the county, are you gaining on that problem? Is development occurring faster than the sidewalk program is producing sidewalks?
You know, I don't have a good answer countywide to that, but I can tell you that, as Susan pointed out, the financial limitations of my program are such that I do a very small amount of sidewalk. The capital road programs that the county do, and certainly all of the sidewalk that developers put in when they develop a new subdivision or redevelop, is a much greater percentage of sidewalk constructed annually for the county. So I can only surmise that on a good year I might do a half mile of sidewalk, that as far as adding sidewalk to the county, developers and the county road projects are doing significantly more. Now, whether that's keeping track with the road network, I don't have a good answer for that.
Does this take into account reconstruction of any existing sidewalks that may be below standard? Thinking of street trees that have heaved sidewalks or they're just fallen into disrepair, does that fall under a maintenance program, or would that be considered in this program?
The Highway 99 project that Susan referenced is sort of a special case. Typically, because there are so many areas in the county that have no sidewalk, we've tried to focus this particular program on building new sidewalk. But again, as she pointed out with that one project, in an extreme case, we're not adverse to replacing sidewalk. One of our major granting agencies, TIB, is also evaluating a major change to how they award grant dollars to make maintenance projects much more fundable, and that has the potential to drive our program a little more in that direction. Yeah.
You know, it's something we need to entertain. I definitely agree with that. But currently, right now, money partners won't fund that, so we have to go plan to do that. But like Michael was pointing out, is TLD comes up with a program for sidewalk replacement. But for this particular inventory that we're doing, it is for missing sidewalk. The next step may be for what do we need?
They are actually inventorying all of the existing sidewalks as well, and the condition of that sidewalk. So when we are finally finished with the first ever comprehensive inventory of the entire urban area, so I've got thousands of projects to choose from, we will also have the maintenance data if we need to drive the program in that direction.
Okay, thank you.
Thinking for the future.
And just kind of on that, the note on the I mean, it's pretty obvious in like Hazel, though, where those areas would benefit. I mean, you guys are doing a great job of putting that sidewalk in. The area from 99th Street North to like 134th, is that would appear to rank fairly high through this, I'm guessing. I mean, and are there ways to get grants for areas that are kind of blighted? I mean, is that part of this process as well?
Blighted, I'm not sure about, but granting agencies do sometimes have their typical focuses. TIB, one of our major partners, likes to construct metro area sidewalks such as the Highway 99 or Hazel Belt component, where you're in an urban area and you're connecting a lot of stuff. The WatchDOT pedestrian and bicycle program is very focused on areas where there is a track record of injuries or accidents, and the Safe Routes to School program is fairly obvious where their interests lie. So we try and have a variety of projects to have good candidates for all of the programs, but they each kind of have their specific thing, and right now we're not aware of a program that really focuses in on the poverty aspect. Although many of those programs I mentioned do have a component that evaluates or gives priority to blighted areas.
And I know that like EPA had some things a few years back for like Tacoma, which is, was a stormwater kind of water quality, but it was mixed in with urbanization and kind of, it's those kinds of things that are broader. I'm not sure what grants are, I'm sure you're seeking those out, but that seems like an obvious area in need.
You know? And sidewalks in general are kind of a tough sell. You know, we were very thankful of the three or four programs we found. Typically, the big grant programs like to fund big road projects, and so thankfully we include sidewalks and bike lanes on those projects as well. Those are just more attractive projects sometimes, bigger headlines, bigger impact than quote unquote simple sidewalks.
I'd like to definitely have time to talk about the rural centers. More comments?
I was just going to say, so just quick rough math, and we're looking at best case scenario with the funding that you have at 1,800 feet, that's at $250 a foot. So really limited then on what you're going to be able to do without some serious grant money that comes in to support.
Yes, leveraging grant, aligning this criteria more tightly with the grants that are available is a huge goal of this program because, as Chris mentioned, some of the grant programs will fund 100% of the project, no match. So the better our criteria is at sniffing out those projects, yes, you're absolutely correct, the more we will be able to construct.
So with that in mind, I guess a thought, my two bits is the trail access may make sense to go up into destinations. I get the quality of life connection. And then I'd see the health outcomes almost becomes more of a poverty, ADA, affordable housing component, since that seems to really tie in with grants. And I'm just looking at how you value and how you attribute for the prioritization of sidewalks. And then from a personal, from a user perspective, and then also in communities and how we, you know, and looking at different communities and where they're placed and use, to me, the safety and comfort scoring is quite a bit higher than I would have it in relation to destinations. Given the limited resources, to me, I would put a much higher prioritization on destinations because of the actual use. I would look to have a like-for-like balance between safety and destinations. And my concern would be that you end up putting sidewalks that are not used in areas that are safer per your scoring, whereas to me, it's more important to put them in places that they're going to be used. There needs to be a safety component, but to me, that destination component should ideally would be higher.
That's a good observation, and one thing that isn't real obvious the way it's written, and I may have to apologize for that. 50 points is an absolute maximum. If like most areas in the county, you do not have a pedestrian or bicycle collision history,
the maximum you can score under safety and comfort is 29 points compared to 20 for destinations. So unless there is a safety issue there, it's a lot closer than the maximum scoring would look. But I understand where you're coming from, and I won't necessarily disagree with that. We tried. Yes, that's a good point.
We'll look into that.
I know you're trying to balance it out, but that's just my two bits.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep, absolutely. The point distributions might change a little bit by the time we finish our outreach with all the organizations Susan mentioned.
Point about and to the question about whether are we able to design sidewalks. Other than folks frustrated about being permitted, I get calls from folks about safety and sidewalks, traffic, and infill projects. So I think we're not keeping up with sidewalks. We are certainly where you're building them, but where we have existing neighborhoods and they've growth around and they're partial. Sidewalks. That's what we're seeing a lot of constituent and citizen concern about safety. So I get those calls now. Highway 99, we were just talking about yesterday. This is like high on my radar for obvious reasons. So is anybody on the team 99 in here? So we're going to take a look at some of those design standards with regard to sidewalks and how expensive they are along the way that they built, like the design standards. Additionally, I've been working with our budget office and Susan's team and a couple other counselors about how we'd be looking at those kind of needs. We're all like crazy right now for obvious reasons, and these projects fit very, very well. So we're going to look at possibly a budget package this year to add some money to the fund and help leverage additional funds, and look at a policy on how it's going to be going forward. So. Right now, it's been a lot of debt, and I think we need to put this money back in the community where those who pay it can see it and take it back together. So those are just a couple things going on that add to this conversation that I want to think about.
Thank you.
Great, thank you.
So if there are no other questions right now on the actual scoring items, the items to think about are kind of important for steering the program. One of the general kind of unwritten rules we've had to date, because there are so many areas, as Councilor Ellison mentioned, where there are no sidewalks at all. If there's sidewalk on one side of the street, we've had kind of an informal policy of seeing if there's a similar scoring area where there's no sidewalk at all. So sidewalk on one side has been kind of an informal qualifier, with the rare exception of something like a Highway 99. But as a general principle, we're curious how DEEP feels we should handle scoring when maybe there's a sidewalk request on a typical road and there's sidewalk already on one side. Should we continue that practice? Should we do something different? What do you think?
I think that having at least some accessibility compared to none, merits a little higher ranking. There might be considerations for the type of roadway, and obviously like Highway 99, you're looking at that as how you get to the other side of Highway 99, but maybe when you get to the collector or arterial classification, maybe that's a little lower importance or less of a disqualifier, I guess, because it's harder to get from one side of the road to the other. But to me, it makes sense to focus a little bit more on places with no mobility versus those that have some. That's my opinion, I guess.
No,
yeah.
That's how our funding department looks at it.
Other thoughts?
I think the only caveat I'd have to that is just if you have an amenity like a park or something like that that doesn't have a trail right at that side, just at the adjacent location of that, that would be something to take in consideration, but that would be it.
Okay.
Otherwise, completely agree.
So, other thoughts from anyone on? Okay, so extending that a little bit, there have been questions come up about building sidewalks in some of our rural centers, typically, again, because of the need, because of where that's where the destinations are and where the traffic is, creating perhaps bigger sidewalk, bigger safety issues. The program is focused on urban roads, and in fact, our arterial atlas does not stipulate sidewalks for roads with a rural classification. But their question has come up: should we treat rural centers a little differently, and perhaps look at building some sidewalks in some cases in rural centers? Again, thoughts?
Do we have two evaluation systems, one for urban, one for this for rural centers?
And I guess part of that is defining what that center is, and I mean the population and geography around that center. I mean, if everybody's driving 5 miles to get to that, you know, obviously the sidewalks would be pretty concentrated within whatever, you know, that center is. So I don't know if that's been something that's been looked at.
Well, the comp plan, I believe, has the rural centers. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So they're very identified. So do we take missing sidewalk components?
I guess the piece is, are there people that are actually walking there now? I mean, that would be the question.
Yes. Is there a rural center?
And that is the question.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a couple of rural centers that I can think of, but won't be, so we can stay at a general policy level where there's occasionally a big demand for a sidewalk, but one of the questions we have that's not easy to answer with current technology is, how many people are actually walking there today? And, you know, where are they walking to? And if you compare, say, one of those rural centers to a busy neighborhood in urban Clark County, how do we apportion our resources to try and serve everybody at least a little bit?
The other alternative to sidewalks in rural centers might simply be widening the shoulder or providing a detached asphalt pathway. Minimum. We've done that for school connections, for instance. It's offsite. It's past our project. We still don't need to make the connection, and it's been acceptable to at a minimum until the adjoining properties develop and create the actual sidewalks. We'll do 5, 6, 8 foot wide asphalt path to at least provide that connection. So if it be necessary to provide some kind of pedestrian access in the rural centers, that's what I might lean for. Also, it kind of maintains the character a little bit better, too, of a rural center as opposed to something more urban. And works better for stormwater and stuff, too. I mean, you can still maintain the same drainage and everything else.
Those are really expensive.
Yeah. So, any other thoughts on any aspect of the sidewalk criteria? You've given us some good things to think about, and we appreciate your time and your thoughts, but anyone having last thoughts to send us away with as we look at doing more outreach and then implementing something in early 2018?
I'm kind of looking at your destination scoring. To me, I guess I partly feel like schools are being underrated a little bit. I know all these are kind of given equal point opportunity.
Yeah.
That's a good point. If I think about, there are a lot of kids, obviously,
that walk
going to school. And those pedestrians don't always have the same level of good judgment, understanding of safety considerations, and haven't had as much of a chance to have good judgment about that.
So, I'm glad you mentioned that, because there's one other item in this criteria that I wanted to ask the committee about. Again, it's kind of hidden. But currently, we, under safety, if you are on a post, if we're building a sidewalk in a posted school zone, you get points in the safety category, and then you get points in the destinations category, recognizing that schools are sometimes, you know, evening activity centers, athletic fields. They're multi-purpose facilities, not just from 8 to 5. So, schools are kind of, when you combine both in the unique situation of getting potentially twice the points of any other destination, which is similar to how we're treating them now, but if we need to give them more or less weight than they currently have, that's certainly something we could look at. A couple of our granting agencies, like in a posted school zone, which is pretty clear cut. Some of our granting agencies, like on a defined safe route to school, which the school district set up, does the committee have thoughts on which one of those would be more valuable? Posted school zone is perhaps a tiny bit more restrictive, but safe routes to school can tend to change as enrollment changes and neighborhoods change and schools decide a particular area is either safe or no longer safe for kids to walk to. So are there thoughts on that subject?
Quick thoughts on that, and then we're gonna have to wrap this one up.
I just think they're probably equivalent. I mean, I don't think we can. I mean, it's you're talking about children, so I mean, I think it's hard to say one is better than the other. Okay.
Yeah. Very good. Well, I'm hearing the signal. We need to wrap up.
Yeah, we're gonna have to call it everybody.
Thank you all very much.
No, that was great.
Our names and group are on the front page. If there's anything that occurs to you, feel free to call us after the meeting or in future weeks. And thank you for your time.
Thank you. I've always wondered, those sidewalks going to nowhere sometimes drive me crazy. All right, early grading, processing, and I would like to say that the project delivery detail of the plat approval bill, I think we should be able to get both of those done within 5 minutes, I hope.
We can even table project delivery.
Okay, we'll see how we're doing.
We'll have more to let you know about at the next meeting.
Okay, we'll see how that is.
We'll actually kind of be close to wrapping things up.
I know everyone's nervous about the timing here. All right, so early grading. So, Diana, Ali, and Eric.
You know, I'm going to try to make this really quick because I think this is a work in progress. Yeah. But I want to kind of update us on everyone on where we're at and where we're going to go. So it got kind of split into two things. The first one is streamlining the early grading process. And we had a committee meeting, we kind of all got together. And some of the things we were looking at is trying to get to basically an over-the-counter grading permit request kind of after first review. So instead of having to go through another, 7 day process, right. We want to get it out of that process, we can get early grading quickly.
That's after first civil review?
After first civil review, yeah. So some of the things we looked at was basically the subdivision TIR and the SWIP can act as the grading TIR, so we don't need a separate one. We can include it in the SWIP itself. That's kind of what we talked about doing. The other part was, not all plans are created equal, and not always is a plan set after first review ready for grading. So we talked about having like a box that could be checked on the review sheet that goes back, almost like you get for a pre-ed, is it that completely vested or not? And if staff feels that the review was at a certain point where they can check a box saying eligible for early grading, then you could basically come in and pull an early grading permit after that. And we're not there yet. We haven't worked all the details out, but that's, I think, what we're working towards. So to kind of summarize that, any other comments on that one before we move to your SFRs? No? Okay. So another piece that came up was SFRs, a policy change. I don't know if it was a policy change, more than a realizing it wasn't being enforced properly with grading when it applies to SFRs. SFRs in general, the pieces associated with an SFR are normally exempt from certain things. However, there's certain cases where grading is significant, where there's large offsite, not even offsite, but large on-site driveways that fall above the threshold for a grading permit, and the county hasn't previously consistently enforced that policy. And when they looked at it, they decided, yes, we have issues that come up from some of these large, long driveways that affect neighboring properties, and there is a need to review some of these. So they kind of put out a memo, and it caused a huge stir. I know I probably got 10, 12 emails from different builders through the BIA email saying, what's going on here? SFRs are complicated enough. Now we've got another hoop to jump through. And there was a little, I think, misunderstanding on it and a little misinformation. So we tried to clear that up in the meeting. Some of the highlights are, yes, it does affect some of the sites, and some of them will require grading permits, but very few, and only larger roadways, and when you have a significant amount of grading. There is already code there, and the code doesn't specifically exclude, long driveways, things like that. It does exclude things normally associated with a single-family residence. Some of the things that came out of that was there shouldn't be SEPA. So the state code clearly exempts any infrastructure built to single-family home, even up to like 20 to 30 units, depending on the area. So it's clearly exempt from SEPA. The only time SEPA would be required is if you're doing work in a critical area over a certain amount. So those may still require SEPA, but normally that's not what we're talking about here. Also, the way they were calculating grading quantities was not consistent with the state specifications. So when you look at quantities, you're talking about dirt or earthing materials. And in the code, it talked about asphalt and concrete. Well, the intent of that was if you're using recycled asphalt or recycled concrete or those materials as your fill, that counts towards your fill. What should not count towards your fill quantity is the structural component of your pavement. So previously, when the county was issuing grading permits, they were taking your base rock and your asphalt quantity and adding it into your grading quantity. When you do that, it triggers the thresholds a lot quicker. So I think we all agreed that those should not be included. That's not grading. That's a structure. So it is basically grading to the subgrade. And a lot of times on these rural roads, you're building it right at the surface or right over an old farm road. So you're not doing much grading at all. You're building it at the surface. So in those cases, you have to deal with the stormwater. You might have to put culverts underneath, but it's not grading that would trigger a grading permit. So those are the big items I think that came out of that committee, unless you guys want to add anything.
On the grading piece, the SFR is calculating the stormwater all in one, so we're looking at only charging the basic fee, not the 125 or 139 on the stormwater fee, just the basic fee for the grading portion for whatever threshold of the grading is.
Thank you. I had that actually on my list and I skipped over it. So
we're not any public fees, we're not incurring any stormwater.
Well, in some cases you have the stormwater fee and then a base grading fee if you trigger the quantities without counting your road materials and all that, which shouldn't be that often. It's a pretty significant site and it's a pretty significant driveway that's going
to
trigger
now. Related to that, after the meeting there was some discussion about the inspection piece. The building folks, the building safety, they inspect the building and the driveway road associated with it. So the question is whether there is a need for inspection of the grading plan that is required for. So we have to do some internal coordination. Because again, you know, if we have to have two inspectors, one from development inspection and one from the building, that would not be efficient. Besides, you know, folks have to pay more fees. So if you know, we come to agreement that the building safety would inspect the whole thing as they do today, including grading that is triggered by the road on Friday, which they do today anyway, we might be okay. So just to let you know.
Sounds good. So next steps, I think we're going to wrap this up and try to get to the next topic. Next steps, I think, is staff's coming up with some new kind of language for their handout, if that's not already done. And we're looking at, like, the review check sheet for the engineering review to allow for that early grading in that sheet. So I think once those are kind of formulated, we maybe meet again. And once we have a full proposal, we'll bring it back to this group and get it implemented as soon as we can, because I think it's a huge savings for the industry and the county as well.
That's great.
And with that, unless there's any questions, should we move on to the next topic?
Questions,
yes.
Comment, I love how fast you talk to. Good. Questions or comment? Because you know, I got these yin yangs here going like this. Really, well, really, really comforting.
It sounds great.
Yeah. It's a wonderful feeling.
I know.
I'm really impressed that, and thank you for all the work you guys are putting in. I mean, some of these things we were talking about, low-hanging fruit and stuff like that, really important things that are going to really hit the ground and make the difference. We really seem to be hitting those, and people are spending a lot of time doing that. So staff, thank you, and Eric and everyone else who's putting in their time to get these things done. So I know this is one we've been talking about for a little while now. So
it
sounds like we're getting close, and that's exciting. Any other comments on that? Awesome. That's great. So we do have a few minutes for project delivery.
I'll just bring everybody up to speed. You can chime in when you want. At the last meeting that we had with the details group for the project delivery, stakeholders group, we got through a lot. We probably got a list of 35, 40 items. Susan has added some items to that. She's also organized all of the items into some priorities, high, medium, low priorities. She has bracketed some items that are very similar in nature. Some items that are more procedural or ones that are more code-related. And it runs the gamut. It's you know, preliminary reviews, site plans and subdivisions, final engineering reviews, final plat reviews, post-decision reviews, legal, environmental, kind of runs the gamut. I thought we got through a lot in that year. And we've provided, you know, there are some items that are, people have tasks to perform. I've got a short list of items that I need to do. We've moved some items to a monitoring level, some that will come to us directly. Some items that are maybe have been deleted or are, you know, duplicates very close to what other items are. So we're going to kind of probably get pretty close to getting through the list at our next meeting. Susan, I mean, you can chime in at any time, but some of the items are broader that we'll probably need a full meeting for just those topics. But what we're doing is we're ticking off what we can, like we always say, low-hanging fruit as we can, with recommendations for policy changes or procedural changes or whatever it might be. Haven't really gotten into any code changes yet, but we've identified those items that might require some code changes, and so then staff would come back to the group with some potential code revisions for that. We're thinking, you know, I think, at least I was thinking that this might be something that might be a six-month process. I think we'll be able to cut that down a little bit insofar as meeting as the group, but I think some of the code-related items will take a little bit longer. Like, it might drag into the next biannual code revisions and stuff. So once we have a good handle on everything that we've accomplished and resolutions for a lot of these items, then I think, well, that's when I'll be able to give a little better presentation here as far as the specifics.
Okay. Sounds good. And
yeah. I have a comment, but I'd like to hear from Susan.
Okay.
I agree with what Mike had to say. I think we're getting through a lot of items. I think there's some really interesting ideas, such as adjustments instead of variances and different ways of doing things and process improvements. So I agree. I think we're really making good progress. And we're currently working on the adjustment language and looking at flat notes and seeing if there's any that we can word better, standard flat notes, if we can get better wording or get rid of any of those, and how they're working are the two things that Vicki and I are looking at right now. So, I think it's a good group.
We brought somebody else on to the group from the development community, Andy Nutbrock with PBS.
Okay.
Somebody that I've known real well. We started our careers together over in Portland, and he and I also sat on the when we did the code rewrite for the commercial zones. I think he has a lot of input. He's in a similar position that I am at his firm, and sees the development side, the development review side, the engineering side, and kind of all aspects of it. So I think we needed to have another voice on there from the development community, and I think it's going to be really good.
Perfect.
Steve Rash was on the committee.
He still is. He was just unable to make it, yeah.
Okay. This is my comment. This board is well served by the people in the committee. Smart people that know their stuff and know the details, unlike some other members of that committee.
I'm smiling because I would be right along with you.
These guys dive into the details and you're very quick with it. So I understand sometimes a little bit of the frustration.
Sure.
I just want to acknowledge that. You guys are right on it. The only thing, the only value that I think that I can bring in the future is that we keep the timelines that we have with this review process. And there's a lot of good stuff happening, but if we don't keep our timelines, I think we take a half a step backwards. But I just want to acknowledge the good work that these folks are doing, the time they put into it, and the expertise. You guys are doing a great job.
Thank you all.
It's not from me, but it's from you. And I recognize that.
Good, thank you. And we appreciate that, but I think that you're still going to be valuable on the group, so don't think you're getting out of this.
Yeah.
Because,
I don't think you're trying, yeah.
Because we need someone on there that isn't in the trenches, that has a little different way of thinking about it, because we've been doing the same thing the same way for some decades. If it's you have a unique way of coming up with some, you know, not, oh gosh, I didn't even think about that.
So you're always valuable.
Stick around.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah.
One comment on timelines. For preliminary review, we have a new planner starting on Monday.
Yeah.
His name is Scott, and he comes from another county, and I was spacing out.
It's all right. It works.
And Angie Merrill was recently promoted to planner.
Yeah.
And Harriet Padmore requested transfer from engineering into land use review to take Angie's position. So we're going to have net one additional staff. We're asking for one additional planning tech in the December budget, which I think will help us continue to meet timelines, because it's getting a little bit better, but June, July, August, we're just, I'm sure, same thing for you, but we missed some timelines.
Susan, thank you. And also, one of the issues that came up at our last meeting, if I can digress,
you bet.
30 seconds, was how to handle some of the early issues that were maybe not being resolved in the time that the staff was hoping they'd be resolved in, and would we go to a conditional date for the public hearing on a plat, for example. I just really had trouble with that. So that's the other timeline topic.
Good point. That's a good point. So that, is there any comment from the peanut gallery, in terms of I'm watching my time, but you're more the long, you're more the big, you're the 30,000 foot view committee. Is there any, what's the 30,000 foot view committee doing?
I
don't know.
No, we're again.
No,
we've been waiting for them again to catch up. I think a few of us are feeling some pressure lately. It's sort of alluding to, to move some things along. And so I know at least Marty and I have talked about, really getting pen to paper to push some of the big ideas that we've had to address the cultural issues.
Good. Well, good.
And Marty had to go, he asked me to echo Jamie's comments in that he's trying to get his head around the best way to address culture. So, I think he would appreciate input if you guys have it. He's thinking about facilitator. He's thinking about what staff should attend. He's thinking about who from the community should attend. So if you guys have thoughts, I think he's very open to those.
And we'll do that. We'll talk about that. And culture is a big thing that I know that everyone's on board and trying to work on, including the counselors, and had discussions with Marty on that too. So, okay, well, this leads in to something that I'm very excited about, and I'm hoping this will be a quick discussion, and we will we'll do public comment and get out of here. But a new bill came down that we were made aware of from actually, I was made aware of it from Marty, but it allows, and I believe it's in front of you, it allows final plats to be, the signing authority to be delegated on final plats from the counselors to a designee, probably county manager, community development director, public works director, you know, maybe two, you know, two or three people in case there's a, you know, perfect storm and everyone's out of the office. This is something that Deeb has talked about. We looked at it a year or two ago. We looked at it. The law didn't allow us to delegate. We wanted to delegate. We were thinking it was a great idea. I think we brought this on because we wanted to get it quick. It's a very, very simple, change. Basically, it's in there. If it's in this copy, it's under. It was underlined in the copy I had. It may be.
Yeah, third to last page.
Yeah.
Page two.
You can see where they say here the legislative authorities of cities, towns, and counties may be. May by ordinance delegate final plat approval to an established planning commission or agency or such other administrative personnel in accordance with state law or local charter. Our thought is if this group is as excited as this as I am, this will take a lot of pressure off of, I mean, this is the lowest of low-hanging fruits because anyone that goes through final plat, when you got to hit that deadline to get on the council's agenda, and then you miss that deadline, and you lose another week, and it's a two-week process anyway. I mean, this adds up to, you know, a savings of 2 to 3 weeks in my mind. I mean, everyone says 2 weeks, but to me, it's 2 to 3 weeks because I've been one of those ones that, oh man, we just missed that deadline, and it's like you got to be kidding me, and we're another week down the road.
Is anyone opposed to it?
Is anyone what?
Is anyone opposed to it? The board? Anyone?
I think you know the polling we have, the board's pretty excited about it too. You know, I think we've got to talk to the board a little bit more. The thought is to actually put this into biannual. That's the thought. So like this would move October 19th through planning commission.
That'd be great.
So one.
Oh no! No cold water.
You may still have an answer. So the legal notice already went out and the CEPA already went out for biannual.
Yeah.
My understanding is that Colette has something going to the Planning Commission in November. So we may be able to catch, and did you do these?
I did it.
Yeah. You did it, okay.
The lawyer did it. With the knife.
The practicing.
he
promised, he said he would. I didn't believe him, but he did.
Well, I emailed Jan and I was like, how did you get these done? I didn't think you were going to be able to get these done. He's like, I didn't do anything.
I just like
that. Awesome.
Nice job.
I will give these to, if you can send this to me by email, I will get this to Colette. Tomorrow was the deadline for getting a draft. So I think that we're still on for getting to November, but Planning Commission and then December with the board.
In biannuals.
Yes.
That would be, is there anyone here that, I figured this would be a quick discussion, sir. Is anyone here that's opposed to this?
No one here better be opposed.
This is one of the best things to ever happen. I mean, this is one of the best emails I ever got in my life.
Yeah. So
I'm serious.
Let me just watch.
It's very sad, actually. Sad life. That's the best email.
The documents again, and thanks to Marty hugely for making Jeff and I aware of this.
Yeah.
Senate Bill 5674, you saw it pass the Senate unanimously. There was some nay votes in the House, but regardless, it was signed into law effective July. I've attached the RCW 5817-100, which is kind of the critical one, which says that it's in that first paragraph, provided that the legislative body of a city, town, or county may by ordinance assign to such commission or agency or any department official or group of officials such functions. That basically is the triggering language allowing the county council to send it down to a staff level. And then so what I've done for everybody to speed up but it references final plats and the other
chapters. Okay, very
good. So just trying to make it easy.
Sure.
So I took the final plat procedure by county code, and the first strike through is under that C. The five there, upon consideration of the approval criteria, and it basically, the process historically has been the official looks at it, says okay, it's ready to go to the board.
In this case, really, he just needs to ensure that it complies with those criteria. And then if it does at 6, he just signs it, sends notice to the final plat folks, and then the responsible official says, okay, go record it. Pretty basic changes.
Perfect.
Yeah.
I wanted to give you a hug, man. this is great. And Jamie did. I didn't believe him.
He didn't believe me.
You never know. I didn't know. He really did step to the plate and got this done, because it was just yesterday, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I think it was yesterday. So, let's get a motion on this, because this is really important. Everyone understand, obviously, what's going on?
Yeah, well, you want the motion.
Is there a motion to adopt? Jamie, what do you want the motion?
Sure. I think we should make a motion to forward this recommended final plat language to the board for adoption in the biannual code amendments pursuant to the new state law that was passed amending the procedures for final plat.
Perfect. Do you want to put that in a motion, or was that a motion?
That was a motion.
Yeah. Perfect.
Oh, second.
Second? Any I'll discussion?
Second. Second.
All right. Okay. Who first? Who second?
Jamie's
motion.
Jamie's
motion.
I second.
Mike second.
Okay, so the motion is to take Jamie's suggested language and along, and I'm glad the motion included also the reference to the law, and put it into the biannual code, recommend that goes into the biannual code changes. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Awesome. Well, that is good stuff. We can get that done. Because that will, I know in this group, everyone knows, but that will take, there's a lot of pressure out there. I know everyone's feeling it. I know staff is definitely feeling it. I think that'll give everyone a bit of a breather, because they won't feel like they have that deadline. I think that'll just chill everyone out.
And Susan,
very temporary, maybe, but just what we might need right at this very moment. So, public comment. No?
I don't have
any. Oh, God.
I was just going to say real quick, this goes to your culture and big picture committee. You know, we just got out of a meeting with Sue and half a dozen folks from the county on trying to refine this bonding process. And the fact that, what we got done in an hour would have taken a month of emails, and we probably still wouldn't have mutual understanding. So the ability to, I asked for this meeting last week, and so the responsiveness of staff to actually be able to meet in person with people that understood the topic at the time, almost like a pre-ask conference, was so valuable. I mean, and this is a project we've got this hiring clean your class, so failure is not an option. So the more you can codify or incorporate that into your cultural principles.
The basically, what you're saying, the open communication, getting together.
You gotta do it in person.
I
get this stuff done by email. I'm sorry.
I 100% agree. There's definitely a lot to be said for that. If you can get people in a room and get them communicating and compromising, saves a lot of time at the end of the day. Anything else for the good of the order? Look at that. 420. And if it wasn't for this, we would never have gotten it done. Sure. Thank you all very much. Thank you.
Thank you.